Here it's week two of Exploring God, which is asking some big questions. And today's topic is there a God? Which maybe is a question you're thinking, I bet I know where he's going with this one. Yes, is probably the answer. And so since it's nice and dark in here and it's comfortable, I'm just going to kind of doze. But that's not probably a good idea, because there is a sense, especially if you've grown up in the church, where maybe you know the answer that we're going to talk about today, that, spoiler alert, it's going to be a yes. But if you're pressed on the question, if somebody comes up to you and says, is there a God, maybe you're a little bit hard-pressed to come up with an explanation as to why. Maybe you lack confidence in the ability to say why. But today, I think about the night where I was camping. There was a windstorm. And some of you have heard this story because it's kind of a crucial one in my development. But there was a night that I was camping and there was a windstorm. And the wind brought down this big willow tree right on top of a tent, not far from where I was. And when that tree fell, it crushed the man to death who was inside of it. And my dad and I were the first ones on the scene. And then just a few moments later, I was back, and these majestic, like 100-foot-tall ponderosa pines are falling. They're just breaking and flying and crushing things, and it's this chaotic, devastating time. And I remember standing and looking up at this tree that was just a little ways ahead of me, and it's just leaning, and it's just threatening me. It's just creaking and bending in the wind about 100 kilometers an hour, and it's just leaning towards me. And I was not a Christian at that point in my life. I was just turned 16 years old. And I remember thinking, though I'm not a Christian, if there's a time to pray, this is it. But oddly enough, just a few hours before that, about 8 p.m., I had smoked a bowl with my friends and then taken some rocks and thrown it at the tent of other kids trying to egg them on for a fight. And so in this night, it's kind of odd how at 8 to midnight, I was living as if there was no God, there was no supernatural being. His existence or righteousness or the way I was supposed to live had no bearing on my life. And then all of a sudden, the wind picks up, the trees start falling, life is beyond my control, and it's the big invisible man in the sky, that's the one I go to. And it's bizarre how I just so willingly lived with this idea that there was no God, and it didn't really matter how I lived. And then all of a sudden, I was very interested in his intervention in my life. And I think, was it just survival? Am I just wanting to make it through this night? Is it because I realized that a couple hundred yards away, a tree came down and crushed a man to death, and I have no reason to expect that I might not be next? I have no hope to know with any certainty that I wouldn't be next in this? I mean, or was it just that I wanted to have my cake and eat it too? Or in my case, I wanted to have my joint and still live under the sovereign care and watch of God. I mean, that's how I was living, and this night was influential to me because I think in a way my soul was awakened to something. It was awakened from what was this comfortable rejection of a God that I somehow, some way longed for and hoped existed and desired would give purpose to my life. I longed for and believed in that, but I recognized that the lifestyle that came along with it, the commands of God, didn't jive with how I preferred to live. And it was about a week later that I found myself again in what felt like a perilous situation, although in hindsight it was probably just my fear of heights that made it seem so. But I had climbed down a mountainside with my friends and then looked back up and thought, I can't make it up this. I'm going to fall to my death. I can't handle it. And on that way up, again, I found myself in a position where it felt like my situation, my safety was beyond my control. And so again, who do I turn to? I turn to God. And I pray. And I ask him to help me. This God that I somehow intuitively believed was there and was somehow in control and could somehow help. But that night I didn't go to sleep the same. That night I wept under a blanket of stars and I turned away from my rejection and denial of God. And on that night I decided and committed that I would follow him and that I would live for him and that I would love him and that I would live in such a way as indicated that I believed him and loved him and was following him. And I also decided that I would let down my guard and receive his love. And that's my story. That's the story that changed my life. I mean, that's the story that took me on a course that went away from abusing my body with excessive drinking and drugs at 16. That's the story that took me away from feeling the narrative was true, that I was worthless, that I had told myself for so many years, and into believing that God actually has purpose and value in my life. It's the story that took me away from contemplating suicide on a regular basis, just constantly running through my mind, who would miss me if I'm gone? I could get them to care more if I was gone. I mean, it's the story that changed my post-secondary plans. It's the story that changed my career. It affected who I married. It redefined my values. It reordered my priorities. I mean, there is no part of my life that was left unchanged by encountering and believing in God. I'm not the same socially. I'm not the same emotionally. I'm not the same spiritually. And so if somebody comes up to me and says, is there a God? Yeah. I'd bet my life on it. I'd give my whole life to make it known that there's a God. Can you prove it? Not really. And I've had to come to realize, can I prove it? Not really. I mean, it's just it's a difficult thing, and it can't be proved in the way that people generally mean when they ask that question, because they mean empirically. Can you prove this scientifically? Can you tell me a way that my five senses or some sort of verifiable scientific evidence indicates irrefutably that there is a God? And the answer to that is no. Can't do that. And it was in 1952, Bertrand Russell was a philosopher, and he came up with this idea of the orbiting teapot. And this was a huge push towards the burden of proof landing on Christians and becoming a part of our identity as having to prove God. He wrote an article entitled, Is There a God? He was an atheist, an agnostic. He called himself that. And he made this claim that, he's got this quote here. He says, if I were to suggest that between Earth and Mars there's a China teapot revolving around the sun in an elliptical orbit, nobody would be able to disprove my assertion, provided I was careful to add that the teapot is too small to be revealed even by our most powerful telescopes. As in, when somebody says God is invisible. So when we add that, we're kind of free from it. And he goes on and says, but if I were to go on to say that since my assertion cannot be disproved, it is an intolerable presumption on the part of human reason to doubt it, I should rightly be thought of as talking nonsense. But if, however, the existence of such a teapot were affirmed in ancient books, taught as sacred truth every Sunday, and instilled in the minds of children at school, hesitation to believe in its existence would be a mark of eccentricity and entitle the doubter to the attentions of a psychiatrist in an enlightened age or the inquisitor in an earlier time. Basically, if you're to suggest without any proof that there is a God, you need psychiatric help. And if you expect me to disprove it based on that, that's foolishness. And I think this was a big contributor to why the burden of proof now is on Christians to prove there's a God as opposed to anyone else to have to disprove there's a God. And more recently in 2003, Christopher Hitchens, who I believe is now deceased, he said that what can be asserted without proof can be dismissed without proof. So here's a member and an author of the New Atheist Movement. He says, if you assert it without proof, there's a God, I can dismiss it just as easily without proof. And it's this moot point. And for Christians, we often experience that it means I must prove there's a God rather than those who don't believe having to disprove him. But the reality is, it doesn't matter how you slice it. Neither really works particularly well. I mean, people point to evil in the world and say there's evil. It's proof that God doesn't exist. There is no good God who oversees everything. Others point to order and creation and the goodness in the world and say, look, it's proof that God does exist. And nobody's convinced by these arguments. I mean, nobody in these arguments is convinced. And it's partly because what's being asked of the people who are trying to prove or disprove something is illogical in the first place. We're saying there's a non-physical, spiritual being, and we want to prove or disprove its existence by our physical and scientific means. The limits that we have here are somehow supposed to go and apply to something other than what we have here. And it's constantly this battle where nobody gets any real ground in it. Nobody becomes, you know, really overwhelmingly convinced, because we think about God being unseen. And we think, yes, there's the historical figure of Jesus, and those who believe that he was one with God would say that he was seen at that point. And there was divine interactions in Scripture and certainly supernatural manifestations of God throughout history. But, on the whole, the norm is that God is unseen. And so many people find this is sufficient to say God does not exist because God is not seen. And yet we live by principles that unseen things are real. We believe that's true all the time. I think about historical figures, Napoleon and Aristotle. I've never seen them, but I believe they exist based on historical evidence. You'll get somebody like Chewbacca and you say, not a real character. I mean, a real character, but not a real figure in history. And if somebody says, well, I don't believe in Napoleon, then you would make them make a case. I'm not going to join you in your disbelief in the existence of Napoleon until you can come up with a case that is stronger than the evidence historically that points towards that character. Or as somebody says, well, I don't believe Chewbacca was real. Well, neither do I. Nobody does. He's fantasy. And so it's this different kind of thing, and it's this unseen reality that is verified by evidences, by clues, that begins to allow us to enter into this conversation, because we have these unseen realities, gravities. I don't see gravity, I just see the effects of gravity. I've never seen a flu germ, but I've certainly lost my lunch as a result of the existence of a flu germ. I haven't seen my love for my kids. I haven't seen it. I haven't taken it out and measured it and weighed it. It's not scientific, but I've seen what the love I have for my kids does in my life. I know without a shadow of a doubt that I have love for my kids, but I haven't seen it. And there's a guy named Robert Creech, and he said, we cannot see the wind. That's another example. We cannot see the wind, yet we know it's real based on how it affects the things around it. And we can't see odor or sound, but their reality is evident to all who can see and smell and hear. He says, within our universe, reality is not demonstrated merely by visibility and provability, but also by effect, by historical reliability, and by plausibility. And so we keep that in mind as we approach a question, because we say, how do we even approach a question like, is there a God, if we don't have something as fundamental as our sight to lean on? And how could we have real confidence in what is unseen if we don't have other irrefutable proof to lean on? And Tim Keller is a pastor in New York, and he writes of the conversation that he had with a young scientist, and that young scientist described his experience as one of being haunted by the existence of God. He said, I'm haunted by the reality that there's got to be a God out there, but he spoke of not having been able to come up with an airtight argument for God. He looked at them and he said, you know, the arguments for God, they've got merit, they're reasonable, but everyone could be rationally avoided at some point. It could be explained another way. And so he said, finally, I can't believe unless I find an airtight argument for the proof of God. But then the pastor Tim took him back and said, okay, well, instead of looking at these things which we have called proofs, let's begin instead to look at them as clues. And then when they went about it that way, they began to see that cumulatively, the clues for God had a lot of force to them. And so it's clues and not proofs that are a more helpful perspective for us to explore this stuff with, as an investigation and eventually a case that is built when put together not by irrefutable proof after proof after proof, but instead clue after clue after clue. And as with anything, you take the clues that point in one direction and the clues that point in another direction, and you weigh them together, and based on that, you make your conclusion. And is there a God? Is God real? It's a question that each person is enabled to answer, and beyond that, each person is required to answer. It's the famous theologian A.W. Tozer said that there's no more important thing about a person. He said, what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. I mean, this informs the way we live. It informs the way we types of things. They talk about how finely tuned the universe is. They talk about a sense of how when we look at the news, we see that people are oppressed and people are hungry, and we're not okay with that. That somehow intuitively we know that is wrong and we want to do something about it, and yet we know that that doesn't contribute to our survival in any way. And we look across time at how common it is that there's laws that are universally accepted, and we look at these kinds of things, but as you would see in the video, which I'll put a link to on the website later, everything that can be said on these matters is pretty rationally avoidable. There are alternative explanations that come about when we talk about these things, and they always are like that because they're clues and they're not proof. And in 2 weeks, I admit, today's kind of message is a bit short-handed when I take out this element of how the creation and the universe that we live in contributes to our understanding that there is a God, that there is a design behind this, that there is purpose to life. Without that, it's a bit of a weaker argument, but we're going to save that for a couple of weeks because it can be its own topic. And so setting aside how creation points to a creator, there's all sorts of other considerations or arguments that one could go on and have. And so as we think about this kind of thing, we can think about what's called the cosmological argument, which is the idea that every effect has a cause. Yeah, I mean, every effect has a cause. Everything came to be because something else caused it to be, which is fine, but then you just go back and back and back and back, and you eventually get to a place where you have to ask, is there an uncaused cause? Was there a beginning that caused something? Was there nothing, but then it was something, and then it came to be? I mean, this is a question that's asked, and we get to the idea that the uncaused cause would possibly be God. It's a plausible explanation. And there's a story of a philosopher named William James who gave a lecture on the solar system and how everything came to be, and then we think maybe it's a myth. But anyway, a little old lady came up to him and after and said, you know, your theory is wrong. And he said, why? And she said, because we live on the crust of an earth which is on the back of a giant turtle. And James responded, well, what does this turtle stand on? Ah, you're a very clever man, Mr. James, she replied, but the first turtle stands on the back of a second, larger turtle. Well, then what does the second turtle stand on, persisted James. The little old lady crowed triumphantly, it's no use, Mr. James. It's turtles all the way down. I mean, some just accept there is no uncaused cause, or at least that is so far removed that why bother think about it? I mean, each thing has a cause, but every turtle is on the back of another turtle. Like, why bother? It's no use, Mr. James. It's turtles all the way down. Why do we even ask the question, is there an uncaused cause at the beginning of it all? And some say the invention of God is a coping mechanism. It's a human idea invented to help us, you know, feel comfortable with the complexities of life and bring some resolve to these things. But the reality is inserting God into the equation gives us a plausible, you know, reasonable explanation for this. Taking God out of it certainly doesn't make any more sense of the situation. Like, we're absolutely left with the same questions. Take God out of the equation. If there was a Big Bang, what preceded the Big Bang? What caused the Big Bang? When did time and space begin? It just goes back. It's turtles all the way down until... And that's where we kind of have this idea that God is described, you know, kind of self-proclaimed the uncaused cause, the creator of all things. That's how God describes himself. And we have this idea, and so whether or not God is a part of the equation, there is the problem of this infinite regression getting to what? And so God says, I am, you know, the uncaused cause. And Norton Herbst wrote, this is part of God's job description, at least in the way we conceive him. And that's to be the all-powerful, eternal, preeminent creator. Because if something else created God, that means there was a time when God didn't exist, and that a more powerful and preeminent being than him exists, and that would make him no longer God. And so I point back to this and I think, well, God is the uncaused cause of it all. That's sensible to me, but yet I know I can't prove that. I can't prove that. All I can suggest is that it seems to be a plausible explanation for a difficult philosophical problem. It's something that we arrive at by faith, because we can't see it or empirically prove it, but we can arrive there by faith. It's far from proof, I'll admit that. But it's a clue, and remember that Creech, who was a PhD, talking about the not seeing the wind and not seeing the odor, but knowing it because we smell and we see the effects of it. And then he says, within our universe, reality is not demonstrated merely by visibility and provability, but by effect, historical reliability, and plausibility. And so the opportunity for the universe we exist in to have a God in it is plausible. It's clues. And it's similar with the moral argument. You may or may not have heard this before, but it isn't always necessarily beneficial to our survival to help one another. Sometimes that's just not the case, but it's in us to do that. It's in us to care and to know the difference between right and wrong. And you look across time and across cultures and across continents, and there's a common sense of law. There's always law. There's right and wrong. And it's darn near universal that murder and lying and stealing are categorized as wrong. And that's just common. It doesn't seem to be conditioned or environmental. But where did this sense of right and wrong come from? Where did it come from? And where did it come from? And how does it act, especially when it doesn't contribute to a naturalist view like survival of the fittest and the advancement of our species? Why would we do something that doesn't advance the evolution of our species? And beyond just the fact that there is this moral sense of right and wrong that people generally across the board kind of subscribe to, there's a sense that we desire there to be a moral standard. We desire for there to be meaning to the goodness that we seek to do. It's a longing that we have. And there was a playwright named Arthur Miller who wrote After the Fall, and in it a character, Quentin, reflected on this as part of life and said, "For many years I looked at life like a case at law. It was a series of proofs. When you're young, you prove how brave you are or how smart, then what a good lover, then a good father, finally how wise or powerful or whatever. But underlying it all, I see now there was a presumption. The presumption was that one moved on an upward path towards some elevation where, God knows that, I would be justified or even condemned. A verdict, anyway. I think now that my disaster really began when I looked up one day and the bench was empty. No judge in sight. And all that remained was the endless argument with oneself, this pointless litigation of existence before an empty bench." Which, of course, is another way of saying despair. And we live. We live our lives as if our actions matter, or at least we sure hope that they do. We want them to. If we view life as a pointless, ongoing argument with myself, just an ongoing litigation before an empty bench, the purposelessness of that is just crushing to our souls. We look for right and wrong to matter, and it's God who has created us that way and who has assigned value to what is right and reward to what is right and given us that. And Tim Keller wrote in reflection of this empty bench idea that if the bench is truly empty, then the whole span of human civilization, even if it lasts a few million years, will just be an infinitesimally brief spark in relation to the oceans of dead time that preceded it and will follow it. There will be no one around to remember any of it. Whether we are loving or cruel, in the end, would make no difference at all. Whether we think the bench is empty or God exists, it does impact how we live. It affects how we live. It affects how we think. And if we see life as temporary and essentially random and at the end meaningless, that's a conclusion that doesn't tend to resonate with the human heart and the human experience because it was created for more. And it's been said that that longing for more is yet another clue. The desire that we have that stretches beyond this physical and scientific world that we live in indicates that there is something more. C.S. Lewis, his author, he wrote, "Creatures are born without desires unless satisfaction for that desire exists. A baby feels hunger, well, there's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim, well, there's such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire, well, there's such a thing as sex. If I find myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world." And this is an observation, a conclusion, a most probable explanation that is consistent with the teachings of the Bible. We have in the book of Hebrews that those who live by faith are living as though they're longing for another country. In Philippians, we have those who are followers of Jesus not noted as citizens of heaven or of earth, but as citizens of heaven, of another place. The people Jesus has chosen to follow him are not said to be of the world, but instead to have been chosen out of it by him. I mean, we're not made for this world, and that explains the inability of it to ultimately satisfy us. I mean, we can be distracted by the things that we find here for the duration of life. We can be entertained by the things that we find here for the duration of life, but we can't be satisfied by what's just here because there is a God who is both here and beyond here. And a philosophy professor describing people as spiritual beings with physical body observes, "You can find me, or you cannot find me, or any of my thoughts or feelings or character traits in any part of my body. Even I cannot. If you wish to find me, the last thing you should do is open my body and take a look." And in by way of an analogy, he says that this is how God relates to space, is as we do to our bodies, that God occupies and overflows it, but cannot be localized in it. But there is a God, and he's everywhere, fully and completely. And so if I get asked, is there a God, without wavering, I'll say, yes, prove it. I wish I could better than I can. And the church has been put in this kind of precarious situation of holding the burden of proof, that we have to prove God's existence to the world, and that's overwhelming. And oftentimes we feel that and we think, I am so unqualified for that, because each person who has come to a place of belief knows that they haven't believed based on irrefutable evidence, empirical truths that they can show another person. Everybody who believes knows that they've come to that by an exploration of the clues and the experiences of life and the way the world has been viewed and it operates, and then a measure of faith added in. And it's that conclusion of clues and logic and experiences with faith that allows us to believe that there is a God. And yet mankind as a whole, it turns away from this. In Romans 1:20, it says that since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, and they've been understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. And it goes on to say that mankind as a whole has exchanged the truth of God for a lie and has set up idols to worship created things instead of the creator of all things. And then we're called to go and make disciples. As a follower of Jesus, I've got to go and make disciples. I've got to proclaim my faith. I've got to share it with people. I've got to lead them to a saving knowledge of the truth. And I think, God, couldn't you have given me like some better evidences? Something a little more sturdy? Something a little less refutable? I mean, I look at these arguments, the cosmological, everything's got a cause, the moral, everybody's kind of shares a common moral sense. Where did that come from? People have a longing for something more, but can each of those be rationally avoided at some point? Pretty easily. Alternative explanations exist and are constantly talked about. But the thing is, we need to realize that as a follower of Jesus, I'm not on the spot. I'm not on the hot seat to prove that God exists. That's not my job. I'm called to proclaim the truth as I find it in scriptures. And by God's design, which is beyond me in my understanding, but by God's design, he's created us so that we can't fully and irrefutably prove him, because faith is required. Faith is something that God has created for us to have. Hebrews 11:6 talks about the importance of faith. It says, "And without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him." Without faith, it's impossible to please God. God created the universe, put us in it, and put a need for faith in us. And that keeps us humble, knowing that he's God and we're not. That puts us in that position, as the song said, to know that his ways are higher than our ways and his thoughts are higher than our thoughts. It gives us the ability to eagerly anticipate something greater than the pinnacles of this life that we experience, long for something more joyful, more peace-filled than this life. And it's that faith that allows us to pair up our experiences and the clues we've examined with the faith that we have, and then please God by living as if he exists and worshiping him instead of worshiping idols. And I believe that the assertions about mankind are true, not just because it makes sense to me in my mind, but because it resonates with me, because it was me. Because on the night that I went and I smoked pot and then I threw rocks at the other kids' tents so that I could start a fight with them, I had zero regard for God, because I didn't want to be held accountable for that. I didn't want to be guided by something other than what I was desiring. I was quite comfortable in my desire of God's existence. I was quite comfortable having exchanged the truth of God for a lie that he was not of consequence to me. But then when push came to shove and the trees started to fall, I was quick to realize that I had a belief in God and that I wanted him to be a part of my life. And so my question today is to consider not just how you think about God, think about how you think about God, and think about how that has implications in how you live. What do you think about God? And is there consistency between what you believe about God and how you live? Or, to be fair, as far as living with integrity goes, I mean, to believe something and then do something about it, if you don't believe that God is true, do you live like you don't believe God is true? That there is no bench, or that the bench is empty. I mean, is there consistency between what you believe and how you live? And I'd love to just have us come here and just give you the proof. If I had a video that had good proof, I would have waited until we could watch that video. But there is no video that has irrefutable proof. But that's not how God designed it. He's given us much to look to and then has called us to faith in the rest. And we can have such great confidence in this invisible, unseeable, eternal God, not necessarily because we see him, but because the universe that we exist in leaves wide open the door to the possibility that there is a God. It is a very plausible option. And with faith, we can believe confidently in what is unseen. We can join C.S. Lewis as he said, "I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun is risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. God, I pray that you would open the eyes of our hearts to see the clues, to not anticipate that they must be proofs, as that will lead us to a fruitless and frustrating search, that we will see your divine fingerprints around the world that we live in and even in ourselves, that we are created in the image of God, that is reflected in how mankind lives out its life, but yet the scriptures have accurately diagnosed what has gone wrong with us and the effects of sin. And we praise you that you have offered an option, the option for salvation from our sins and from their consequences. And we praise you that that is through Jesus Christ. And I pray that with the clues that we see about the existence that is yours as the preeminent, eternal creator of all things, the uncaused cause, I pray that all that we see that points us towards that would be matched by a faith that you give us and that you grow in us, a faith that pleases you, the faith like a child, a faith that allows us to step beyond what we can see and taste and verify by science and believe wholeheartedly in, and give us peace as a result of that, peace in the reality of your existence and the sovereignty of your care, the greatness of your love. And may we, as a result of our time today who do believe in you, be better equipped and more confident in sharing this hope with those around us. May we be obedient to the ability to answer anyone who has a question for the hope that we have, who presses us on this. May you be glorified in us and through our belief. Give us faith. Grow in us faith. Amen. Why don't we stand and sing together?